Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now, since the explosion of recreational running in the 1970s, its popularity has been off to the races. More than 1 in 10 Americans ran once last year. More than 10 million Americans ran 100 days last year. The running industry continues to grow. Americans bought $2 billion worth of running shoes last year. And then there are running shorts, running fanny packs, money for running coaches and clubs, and on and on. But why exactly do we need to be taught and spend all this money learning how to run, something that humans have presumably done naturally for a long while now? This is the question at the heart of Christopher McDougall's new book, which takes him into the world of long-distance running and sends him looking for secrets about running from all over the planet. He's an editor at Men's Health. He's a former war correspondent for the AP and has written for Esquire, the New York Times Magazine, and more. The book is Born to Run: A Hidden Tribe, Super Athletes, and the Greatest Race the World Has Never Seen. It's out now from Knopf. Chris, welcome to WNYC.
Great, thank you.
I want to start with something you say in the second line of Chapter 25. Running shoes may be the most destructive force ever to hit the human foot. Really?
Absolutely. If running shoes were a drug, they would be taken off the market. They do not do what they're supposed to do. At best and at worst, they're actually causing the very injuries they're supposed to prevent.
What injuries and how do they cause them? And I'll admit, I'm a runner and I love my running shoes and what they seem to provide in terms of injury prevention.
I was injured all the time, and I assumed I just needed to buy a better product, that it was the shoe that I was somehow not getting the right shoe. And I kept going to see doctors trying to get my various ailments cured, plantar fasciitis and Achilles tendonitis, name. I was learning Latin by the things that were happening wrong to me. And what doctors told me was, well, the body isn't designed for running. The impact is bad. You need orthotics. But what I discovered was that there is a tribe known as the Tarahumara who live down in the Copper Canyons of Mexico, and they run in the thinnest little homemade sandals. And they never get hurt. They're running healthily into their 80s and 90s. And I thought, what are these guys doing that I'm not doing? And step number one was getting rid of the shoes.
So what do you run in now?
If you could look at my foot, it's like a rubber foot glove. It's called the Vibram Five Fingers. But I like it because it adheres to the foot. It's like dipping your foot in paint. But anything that puts as little between my skin and the ground is what I want.
As little between your skin and the ground, because the conventional wisdom and what a lot of sports medicine doctors will tell you is that you want a lot of cushioning, a lot of padding, especially if the material is just right, that's firm enough but with enough give, and that'll be much easier on your knees, for example.
You know, it's absolutely wrong. And the difficulty is when you think about the human leg, it is one of the greatest load-bearing devices ever created. The human leg can compress down to 6 inches and can expand back up to 3 feet. It is a hydraulic jack that we have hanging from our hips. Why on earth do we think that this little thin layer of foam is going to make a bit of difference in shock absorption?
You delve into the world of extreme long-distance running in the book here in the United States. When you say ultra running, that's the phrase. That's more than a marathon?
Exactly, yeah. Traditionally, it's a race that's longer than 30 miles. They can extend up to 150 or 200 miles.
Why do they do it?
That, I think, is at the heart of my book, Born to Run. The idea is that we look at running as this strange, exotic, painful exercise that needs to be terminated as rapidly as possible. But when you actually break through and do what the body was really designed for, you know, as sprinters, humans are awful. As long-distance runners, we are the greatest on the planet, bar none. We can outrun any creature alive.
How are ultramarathoners viewed from within the more traditional running community?
It's funny about ultra runners because as I spend time with them, any person I thought was nuts thought somebody else was even nuttier. So I was at a race in Death Valley called the Badwater Ultra Marathon. It's 135 miles through the heart of Death Valley in the dead of summer in 130 degrees. So I was there as a support crew for a runner. And he heard about another runner who was actually going to do it twice. He was going to do 135 miles and then turn around and run back. And my runner said, she's crazy. So, how about you? But the thing about it is, it was so exhilarating. It was so fun.
Have you ever run an ultramarathon?
Well, the heart of this book was when I discovered this tribe down in the canyons, I went on this expedition to try to locate them, not taking the precaution of realizing that a very reclusive tribe might be reclusive for a reason, to stay away from people like me. But I did locate them, and I did find this mysterious guy named Caballo Blanco, the white horse, who is this sort of shadowy figure who lives down in the canyons. He wanted to put together a race that would take the best American ultra runners against the best Taru Umara tribal runners. And the reason why was he wanted to sort of spread the word that there was this great wisdom. Because the thing about the Taru Umara is they have no heart disease, no cholesterol, no diabetes, no crime, no violence. They are really the model society, and a lot of it is based on their ability and their love of long-distance running. He wanted to put this race together, and he said, take yourself, what I've shown you here, how to run like the Taru Umara, go home to Pennsylvania, practice, come back in 9 months, and we'll have a 50-mile race. And I said, you're on. I can't run five. I'll try 50.
That's the greatest race the world has never seen, quoting from the subtitle of your book.
It was unbelievable because I left Caballo down there in his canyon hut, and he asked me to go back and spread the word about this race that he wanted to take place. And naturally, I assumed there is not a prayer that any elite ultramarathoner is going to bother to come down to these canyons, which are almost inaccessible, going past drug traffickers for a race against a tribe that probably won't show up. Yet when I started to spread the word, out of the shadows came this guy named Scott Jorick, who's one of the greatest ultra runners alive, and Jen Shelton, who's this gorgeous pigtailed surfer who also specializes in 100-mile races, and Billy Bonehead Barnett, and we ended up showing up at the starting line for a race with the Taru Umara.
Why are the Taru Umara, if they're this good at running, not as well known as some, you know, famous Kenyan runners or somebody?
I think for the same reason that we have this misconception that running shoes will solve all problems. We have this worldview based on our own very limited period in time. For instance, you know, running shoes have only been around for 30 years. Humans have been around for 2 million years, yet we feel like we can't run without them. And we feel like the marathon is sort of the be-all and end-all of competition, yet the Taru Umara have been running for tens of thousands of years, and their style of running is very different. It's much more communal and relaxed, and it's not about individual achievement.
It's not about speed?
Not about speed, yeah. And again, this is a very natural way for humans to run. It's unnatural to go blasting off from gun to tape. It's more natural to run and rest.
There are other groups of people in relatively remote areas, relatively untouched by modernity, who also have low rates of heart disease and crime in their communities and things like that, who aren't necessarily long-distance runners? Or is this more common in remote groups than we know?
When you find an indigenous people that has similar characteristics to the Taru Umara, they're long-distance runners, like the Kalahari Bushmen of Botswana. They are almost identical. They run long distances. They can run an animal to death. And likewise, they are a pacifistic, extraordinarily healthy group of people.
The story culminates in an endurance race in Mexico, as you said, that includes local runners against people from all over the world, including yourself. Do you want to give away how anybody did here?
I'll just say that it surpassed all expectations. At one point, Caballo Blanco, it was an out-and-back course, so you could actually see the front runners if you were from the vantage point of where I was, which is way at the back of the pack. And at one point, Caballo comes up to me, and he's like pouring sweat, and he's red in the face. He goes, I can't believe it. We got a world-class event right down here in the middle of nowhere. And it was true because Scott Jorick, the Taru Umara, Jen Shelton, this was anybody could win race through these canyons.
What did they think of you guys?
That was the genius of what Caballo did, was he understood that the Taru Umara loved the gamesmanship of running. They loved the camaraderie of running. Again, it's kind of weird for us, for like 30,000 of us to sort of show up on a given Sunday to run a marathon and then all go home. What the Taru Umara liked to do is gather and get to know each other. And what Caballo did, again, was sort of brilliant. It's very hard to get down to the canyons, so he had us all meet at a certain tree on a certain day and hike over the Taru Umara and the Americans together, and we forged this bond of friendship.
Christopher McDougall's book is Born to Run, A Hidden Tribe, Super Athletes, and the Greatest Race the World Has Never Seen. Thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.